Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It's our 30 Issues election series. This week, issue 23, Facing Whiteness. Let's listen to just three clips from presidential and presidential campaign history. Then we'll talk to historians Nell Painter and Nancy Eisenberg. If we believe that support for Donald Trump is driven in part by white people's discomfort with an America where they will no longer be the majority, Bill Clinton, as president, was talking about that as a challenge as early as 1998.
Today, largely because of immigration, there is no majority race in Hawaii or Houston or New York City. Within 5 years, there will be no majority race in our largest state, California. In a little more than 50 years, there will be no majority race in the United States. No other nation. No other nation in history has gone through demographic change of this magnitude in so short a time. What do the changes mean? They can either strengthen and unite us, or they can weaken and divide us. We must decide. Let me state my view unequivocally. I believe new immigrants are good for America. They are revitalizing our cities. They are building our new economy. They are strengthening our ties to the global economy, just as earlier waves of immigrants settled the new frontier and powered the Industrial Revolution. They are energizing our culture and broadening our vision of the world. They are renewing our most basic values and reminding us all of what it truly means to be an American.
A minute and a half of Bill Clinton in 1998 on the challenge of a no-majority race America 50 years in the future, as he said at that time. As it comes closer today, maybe we see the challenge even more clearly in Trumpism and the fears that it plays on and reflects. One of the most bracingly honest things ever said about exploiting whiteness in presidential campaigns was said by the late Republican strategist Lee Atwater in 1981. This is 1 minute long, and the sound quality is not great, as he said it off the record in an interview with a political scientist, not for broadcast. But this is 1981, the year after Ronald Reagan was elected president. This was only released after Atwater died in the 90s. We bleep the N-word here, which he says three times rapidly near the beginning of this clip, but you may still find this disturbing.
You start out in 1954 by saying by 1968 you can't say that hurts your backfire, so you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. And you're getting so abstract now. You're talking about cutting taxes, and all of these things you're talking about are totally economic things, and the byproduct of them is blacks get hurt worse than whites. And subconsciously, maybe that is part of it. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that if it is getting that abstract and that coded, that we're doing away with the racial problem one way or the other. You follow me? Because obviously sitting around saying we want to cut taxes, we want to cut this, and we want is much more abstract than even the busing thing, and a hell of a lot more abstract than, you know. So any way you look at it, race is coming on the back burner.
Lee Atwater in 1981 on racist code in the history of Republican presidential campaigns. He went on to run the George H.W. Bush campaign in 88, one with the help of the so-called Willie Horton ad showing a black man's face as the face of violent crime in America and associating it with the policies of Democratic candidate Mike Dukakis. Atwater came to publicly regret the racist overtones of the Willie Horton ad. But in 1981, as we heard, he revealed that he knew exactly what he was doing. One more clip. In President Obama's famous race speech in the 2008 campaign, he talked not only about black America, but also about many white Americans' reactions to being told they have white privilege.
Most working and middle-class white Americans don't feel that they've been particularly privileged by their race. Their experience is the immigrant experience. As far as they're concerned, No one handed them anything. They built it from scratch. They've worked hard all their lives, many times only to see their jobs shipped overseas or their pensions dumped after a lifetime of labor. They are anxious about their futures, and they feel their dreams slipping away. And in an era of stagnant wages and global competition, opportunity comes to be seen as a zero-sum game in which your dreams come at my expense. So when they are told to bus their children to a school across town, when they hear an African-American is getting an advantage in landing a good job or a spot in a good college because of an injustice that they themselves never committed, when they're told that their fears about crime in urban neighborhoods are somehow prejudice, resentment builds over time. Like the anger within the black community, these resentments aren't always expressed in polite company, but they have helped shape the political landscape for at least a generation. Anger over welfare and affirmative action helped forge the Reagan coalition. Politicians routinely exploited fears of crime for their own electoral ends. Talk show hosts and conservative commentators built entire careers unmasking bogus claims of racism while dismissing legitimate discussions of racial injustice and inequality as mere political correctness or reverse racism. And just as black anger often proved counterproductive, so have these white resentments distracted attention from the real culprits of the middle class squeeze, a corporate culture rife with inside dealing, questionable accounting practices, and short-term greed, a Washington dominated by lobbyists and special interests, economic policies that favor the few over the many. And yet to wish away the resentments of white Americans, to label them as misguided or even racist, without recognizing they are grounded in legitimate concerns, this too widens the racial divide and blocks the path to understanding.
2.5 minutes of then-Senator and presidential candidate Barack Obama in 2008. So if we're ever going to approach racial equality or racial reconciliation in this country, we can't just talk about the state of black America. White people have to talk more about being white. That's the premise of this expanded edition of our 30 Issues election series this week, Issue 23, Facing Whiteness. That includes the uncomfortable job of facing white privilege. And if you're white, asking yourself, what do we as white people owe to African Americans to reconcile our historical debts? Even if our own families never owned slaves, even if our own ancestors came to this country poor. We continue the series now with two historians. Nell Painter, Princeton Professor Emeritus, is the author of the widely acclaimed 2010 book, The History of White People. Nancy Eisenberg, Louisiana State University American History Professor, has a new book called White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. Professor Painter, Professor Eisenberg, thanks so much for doing this. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm just curious first about whatever you may have been thinking during those clips in the historical context of your books. I realize that's a very open-ended question, and maybe it puts you on the spot in too general a way, but do either of you have anything like that? Professor Painter, go ahead.
Those were fantastic clips, and all three of them were right. All three of them were speaking a long time ago, so this is not new knowledge, but it's knowledge that I think we should be hearing again, particularly Barack Obama's extended commentary.
Professor Eisenberg?
Yeah, I think that Obama's comments were particularly prescient because one of the points that he's making is this, you know, he makes the point very clearly that not all white people have benefited from white privilege, and that's why my book is about recovering class. Because even the upper white, you know, the white upper class throughout history have looked down on the lower white classes. And that's why we have to kind of return that as part of the equation. All white people do not always stand together. All white people do not always benefit. And I think that Obama particularly highlighted the idea of how that can be the division between blacks and whites can be exploited, particularly the idea of the zero-sum game. This is something I've said, is that politicians, I mean, if we go back to Lee Atwater, politicians know that part of their game is to create, you know, misdirection and to focus on pitting groups against each other as a way to get off who's really in charge. Who are the people with power in this country? And whenever I think about Donald Trump, I often like to think of James Vardaman in the early 20th century. The idea of being someone who's rude and vulgar, someone who is willing, more than willing, to sort of claim to be defending the interests of working class whites, but in fact what that includes is often invoking what Obama said, that the advances of African Americans or minorities in this country is somehow taking away the privileges that should be given to working class whites in this country.
I'm glad that Professor Eisenberg is foregrounding class. I think she's absolutely right there. But I would like to add something, and that is when we think about the situation of Americans, we tend to think of black Americans as race. And thanks to her and others, we can think about white Americans as class. I think what we need to do is think of both sides as race plus class, with race giving us the gut stuff, the emotional stuff, and class being hard to think about, but crucial.
Yeah, I would just add one comment to that. I mean, one of my key themes in my book is the way in which we appropriated English ideas of class. And one of the key themes is the idea of breeding and pedigree. And as I highlight in the 19th century, the idea of pedigree worked very well with racial theories. And that's why we can't disaggregate race and class. We have to kind of understand how those two things work together. But they create a complicated legacy, and that's something I know journalists often don't want to deal with, is that history is not just pitting class against race. We have to understand both of these, and we have to understand them as embedded with a very long history of how politicians manipulate them, how culture manipulates them, and this is something that's really, we have to face up as part of our collective past.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that Barack Obama said in 2008, I would actually take a little exception to, and that is the question of what do white people owe black people. I know a lot of people think that way, and the whole question is, if I have white privilege, does that mean a burden, and so, you know, guilt and all that sort of thing. I'd like us to think in terms of citizenship. What do all of us owe our fellow citizens, our polity, our nation? We are here as citizens, not simply as integers of race.
But what does that suggest in terms of a national process of truth and reconciliation, or the question of reparations, if you will?
Mm-hmm. It means that when we think about race, we also think about citizenship. So, for instance, if there were some attempt at reparations, let's say it would think about helping out institutions like colleges or schools that largely benefit people of African descent, that all of us would be involved in paying in one way or another. We tend to think in terms of money, but there are lots of other ways to think about that. It's not just white people who would owe black people something. It's we as American citizens, all of us, would owe something to the issues that come from our past.
Historians Nell Painter, who was just speaking, author of The History of White People, and Nancy Eisenberg, who's also with us, whose new book is called White Trash. And I think you both write about times in history when lighter-skinned people were considered uglier and less civilized than darker-skinned people, the opposite of what we assume bias to be. Professor Eisenberg, can you give us an example of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the things that we tend to forget. I mean, one of the problems, the reason that the term white trash is so controversial, as I say, it goes all the way back to the English idea that when they were dumping the colonists in the New World, they called them waste people. Thomas Jefferson, Abigail Adams referred to poor whites as rubbish. And this is part of the problem that's very hard for us to fully wrap our heads around, is this idea that I was getting to. The Southern planter class. Many people have written about Southern planters, the way they look at their slaves. There's a hierarchy in the slave community. The slaves that are in the big house are closer to the masters. But what is equally true is that many elite white Southern planters, and I quote one of the leading authorities, Daniel Hunley, you know, put white trash beneath slaves because they were viewed as completely unproductive and useless. And that's something that's hard for us to appreciate, because at the same time they can rationalize denying slaves the rights of citizenship, certain basic legal rights, they also were equally clear about feeling repelled by white trash, who they described as being not quite white, as being diseased-looking, and measuring their children as a sign of the fact that they're never going to evolve, because their children, in a sense, are described as a group of people who have not, they're not just lazy, but they are, in a sense, have inherited inferior diseases. And that's where we get the eugenics movement, is coming out of that whole tradition that I mentioned earlier about breeding and pedigree. So, yes, this is part of our, we have to realize these things can coexist at the same time. You can be buy into a certain racial logic in terms of defining African Americans to uphold slavery, but at the same time, you can buy into a idea of breeding and class, which allows you to, you know, to dismiss poor whites as being so inferior that they'll never be assimilated into normal society.
You also write about the eugenics movement in your book, don't
yes,
you?
Yes, I do. And it's easy to think of eugenics as targeting black people. But eugenics was mostly about people we now consider white. Remember, though, at that time, early 20th century, most educated people and many others thought that there was more than one white race. So you could be white, but you could still be inferior. So eugenics was about those various kinds of inferior white people and getting rid of them or making sure they did not reproduce. And so the great targets were poor Southern white people.
You say people we now consider white.
Yes.
Were there people who we now consider white who were once considered not white?
No. They were always considered white. This is very hard for Americans to wrap their heads around, that our idea of one big equal white race is from the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s.
That recently.
It's a 20th century idea. So in the 1920s and the 1840s and the 1880s, there were all these different kinds of white people. So in the 1850s, there were different kinds of white people. So inferior white people were members of the white race. But the crucial part here is that adult men could vote. That is the telling part. The ability to vote has made all the difference in the world in terms of class and how we think about it in racial terms, because adult men who were black largely could not vote. They were not eligible for patronage jobs. Their views did not make it into the public sphere and into policy, whereas inferior races of white people, Celts, Southern Italians, Northern Italians, Eastern European Hebrews, Slavs, and so on and so forth, the men could vote.
Well, that's not completely true, because the poll tax is also discriminated against the poor.
Indeed.
And scholarship, one of the most interesting pieces of scholarship that I read is a women's historian who showed that poll taxes also discriminated even more harshly against poor white women, you know, if we talk about after women get the vote. Because if you're so poor and you're only going to pay a poll tax for one person to vote in your household, who's going to be denied the right to vote? Obviously, the woman is going to be denied the right to vote. So, yes, I mean, and that's actually part of the logic of the South, too, because there's a lot of hostility of elite Southern whites against the poor. I talk about the, you know, the elite whites who lashed out against James Vardaman and sort of saw them as manipulating poor whites, and they were more than willing to find a way that simultaneously would disenfranchise poor whites and blacks at the same time. And that's, you know, that's part of our history as well.
You're absolutely right, but I hope our viewers don't take away the idea that the burden of disfranchisement fell equally on poor people of both races. That is not the case.
Michael in Harlem, you're on WNYC with historians Nell Painter and Nancy Eisenberg. Hi, Michael.
Good morning. Your guest were earlier, it seemed to me, suggesting that that race, that there is no such thing as white privilege for people who are poor, but now you clarified it somewhat. One of the things that makes white privilege universal for whites is that if you're talking about a lynch mob, if you're talking about someone claiming that some black person has raped them, that happens automatically. No matter how poor you are, you can participate in that. If you're talking about stop and frisk, even today, if you're white, that doesn't happen to you. If you're talking about the past and FHA loans and the GI Bill and access to patronage jobs, those things were available to whites and not to blacks.
So, Professor Eisenberg, when you write a book called White Trash and peg it to class, how do you think it informs the contemporary conversation about white privilege?
Well, again, that's what you have to realize. I'm a historian, and the point that I'm making is we can't equate white privilege with class privilege. White privilege is allocated differently to the elites, to the upper middle class, the middle class, the working class, and people below the poverty line. I mean, I'd like people to remember that today, 42.1% or 19.7 million Americans below the poverty line are white. And in the South, over half of the poor are white. So we can't just throw these terms around and assume that there's some universal definition of what white privilege is and that all whites benefit from that. I mean, even the lynch mobs are very complicated historical events in terms of who participated. We know for a fact that elites participated. They often orchestrated them. So white people were actually lynched in the 19th century and 20th century, not to the same degree. But we have to sort of take into account that we want to be careful and not sort of assume that we can sort of generalize across the board. All I'm saying is we have to take class into account. And if you understand the history of class and the intense resentment that has been fueled by elite whites, educated whites, toward poor whites, that's the part that I want to recover as well. Mm-hmm. Instead of like imagining that all white people like each other, support each other, defend each other's interests, they don't.
Professor Painter, anything to add or contradict?
Yeah, I think part that something else that needs to go in here is that white privilege is so often invisible. And since people can suffer the injuries of class without seeing where there is, I hesitate to call it an advantage of race, but if you took a person who was white and a person who was not white in the same situation, that the person who was white would probably get treated better or assumed to be more worthy. So white privilege can go along with being extremely disadvantaged.
Eva in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, hi. So I want to talk about Bacon's Rebellion in Virginia. Your professors should know about this.
Yes.
Because in 1676 was exactly the moment in which the word white started to appear in the way slavery and was treated. Anyway, the rebellion took place with African and Irish slaves that rebelled, and after that rebellion, the slaves owners realized that one way to cut any success with these rebels was to separate them.
And Eva, I'm going to leave it there for time. Professor Painter, is that your understanding of history? And it it suggests a larger question, which is that there's no nationality called white, like there's no nationality called black. So did the word white come into being to differentiate the various European peoples from the various African peoples mm-hmm. in the context of the United States?
Yes, that early on, we don't get the use of the word white as fully as it would be used later. It appears from time to time. The color is giving us a version that comes from a classic book of history by Edmund Morgan. Morgan sees the gelling of racial difference at that moment. I think we would nuance that a little bit more now, but I think it was very important at the time, a book I think from the 60s, and it should still be read.
We're just about out of... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I write about Bacon's Rebellion, and I think another thing we have to think about is that part of the power of slavery was connected to controlling the identity of slave women and defining slavery. And this happens in Virginia as saying that a slave is someone who is born of a slave woman. So it's about controlling breeding. This was a crucial ingredient in how slavery was instituted.
We're just about out of time, but I'm just curious about the two of you and how you see your places. And I wonder if you think as a white historian and a black historian, you bring different things to your histories of white people, in addition to what, of course, you bring as individuals. Do you think about that, Professor Painter?
I used to get asked about it all the time when I started writing that book early in this century, and it subsided somewhat. People would say, are you writing it as a black person? Like, are you going to get even with us for all the terrible things? I say, no. I'm writing as a historian. And I did write as a historian, and I assume that Professor Eisenberg also wrote as a historian. However, every historian brings his or her personal identity, and your own particular experience can open your eyes to questions that others may miss.
Professor Eisenberg, same question.
Yes. I mean, people could say I am, you know, a middle-class person, you know, writing about poor whites. But I think one of the things that historians can bring is our knowledge. And I think if you read Professor Painter's book or my book, they are thoroughly documented. We read lots of sources as a way to try to inform and interpret what we're looking for. I mean, when I started this book, I didn't have the solution already. So I think it's very complicated. She's right. We do have, nobody can step outside their culture. Nobody's independent of a certain subjective point of views. But I think historians do try to base their decisions on the evidence, and that's what makes our works meaningful.
Louisiana State University history professor Nancy Eisenberg has a new book, White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. Princeton history professor emeritus Nell Painter wrote the 2010 book, The History of White People. Thank you both so much. What a great dialogue.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our 30 Issues Election Series, Issue 23, Facing Whiteness, concludes on Monday with a dialogue between whiteness scholar Linda Martin-Alkoff and New York City Council member Brad Lander.